You're listening to The Morning Show here on Raglan Community Radio, Irirangi o Whangaroa, and in the studio I've got Ngarano Renata. Good morning.
Ai, atamari e te whānau whānui o Whangaroa. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you to you for organising the recent 30th anniversary of our local community radio, but it wasn't 98.1 originally?
No, it was 96.6 until 2006.
What does that technically mean? Because I know it's a detail, like I'm going, okay.
What's the frequency? It's very important if you want to find and want to listen to us on your radio. But it happened because we shifted the transmitter up the hill up to above Extreme, where the cell phone towers are. It was just on the roof here, which is a pretty useless place to have it because it's kind of, we're down in a hollow here.
Oh, okay. So does that mean that it gets a bigger frequency of people being able to?
It goes further. well, it goes further because it's higher up.
Okay. So that's why. And 98.1 means what is the area that it can serve?
Well, the frequency doesn't affect how far away you can hear it. Yeah. It's just the power does. So it's 100 watts now. It was 20 watts then, but it's also up much higher. So it gets over all the buildings and over the hills and things like that and can go further.
Great. Good to know.
Yeah. So that happened in 2006. And the people, the government who, the bit of the government that organises those things said, well, if you want to be more powerful, we're going to have to give you a different frequency.
Okay.
Because you're going to mess with those other people somewhere else.
Oh, and so does that also change like other frequencies or like you say, in terms of interfering with other frequencies?
Well, I don't know what the problem would have been. They know all the frequencies in all the places, right? They've
right,
got four records.
Okay.
But I do know that we're quite close to 97.8, which is the edge in Hamilton. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, thank you so much. It was really interesting. I would have loved to have heard more of, I mean, I know there has been a lot of history given out over the past month.
Yes.
Regarding this event.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's really good to be part of something like this. I don't really know enough about, I was just wondering, who are the clientele of this radio station?
Anyone who lives in the Whangaroa area.
Oh, clientele as in who actually listens. Ai, kia ora.
Oh, well, that's the potential.
Yeah, our potential, like, who is listening?
But
do
then
we know?
No, we don't know because it's just out on the airwaves.
So we haven't done a survey. Can you do surveys like that?
We used to do surveys. The last survey we did was 2014.
Yes.
And we used the phone, the local phone book. But even then, even that last one, we could see that it was starting to be useless because so many people are on cell phones.
And okay.
Now, I mean, even my mother no longer has a landline. Not that she lives here, but it's just an example of someone in their 70s who can't be bothered with a landline. So, and we don't know, there's no collection of cell phone numbers for our area. But there used to be, you know, because we had the white pages. Everyone used to use the white pages.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And the Chronicle still makes a phone book for our area, but so, like, I don't have a landline anymore.
No. Yeah.
We have, the studio has one because we need to route it through the desk when I do phone interviews. But we can't do...
Right.
That was how we did the survey. We'd get the local phone book. We'd do four pages each and do every fourth person on those four pages.
Okay.
And just ring them up and ask them a standard set of questions.
Yes.
So it was fairly good news then. We were commonly listened to by people in town, but I don't know now. I can't say, except... The things I have to read is that advertisers are still advertising with us. We've got lots of volunteers, like heaps of volunteers at the moment, more than we've had in the last 10 years right now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's amazing.
And I bump into people all the time who talk about stuff we're doing. So anecdotally, I know that people are listening, but I just can't give you numbers.
Well, we're celebrating that we're the longest running radio, community radio station?
Independent community station.
Independent community station?
So they're a government-funded community stations like Free FM in Hamilton.
Yes.
Yeah, and they have about four or five times as much money as us to work with.
Ah, so that's another category we're in. That's something to celebrate, eh?
Yeah. There's lots of, then there's little stations all around the place, like up in near Dargaville, Big River FM, and there's one on Waiheke, Altea FM. I think that's what it's called.
And they're an independent radio station.
Yeah, yeah, like us, yeah.
Right. Good to know. Well, I just wondered that because of the whole dynamics of who's actually listening in and with social media. So being like it is, the way that people are receiving information.
Well, and a lot of like, and participating. We, and as you know, we podcast this interview afterwards, and so some people will be listening on that, and I know you've got friends who listen to you on that as well. So that's
absolutely
So that's happening as well.
I wanted to firstly talk about a wānanga that I went to recently, held at Kirikiriroa Marae, and it was the first of its kind in terms of Māori puppetry, karetau. people go, "What? So what's that?"
Well, I had not heard. I did not know that this was a thing until you told me a few minutes ago.
Yeah, so karetau existed pre-European. They were part of the theatre life of pre-European society. There was a huge field of the whare tāpere, which was an organised way of gathering, or it was a huge gatherings of people tribally, intertribally, to celebrate, to entertain within certain environments that were created. And karetau is part of that. So what we have learnt is that there are karetau which are currently in different one. I think it's Philadelphia is one of them. I've got the notes at home. It's quite, yeah, there's quite specific information was given to us during this wānanga, because research, extensive research has been done around why they're there.
So that's in a museum in Philadelphia?
Yeah. And the reason,
and that's not Philadelphia, New Zealand. That's Philadelphia, USA.
Yeah, Philadelphia, USA.
I don't
USA.
Think there is a Philadelphia in New Zealand. Just to be really clear.
Yeah, just. And that there was, there are these karetau and that exist. And, you know, like, I mean, there's a lot of discussion, as we've been sharing this morning, around being kaitiaki, looking after them. And the fact that that's why they've survived. Yeah, I have some questions around that, because what we're also discovering is that the taonga, if they're not with their families, they're dead. Like they're not being given the life that they were designed to have. So they're really artifacts, is not taonga tuku iho. Artifacts are dead things, you know, that are not regarded with any respect or given any mana. So karetau, like many of our taonga tuku iho, which are held by museums, are living beings, according to Māori.
And so, and these are in museums, like in many places around the world.
Karetau, as far as I know, from the research that was presented to us, they're not as extensive as other types of taonga, carved taonga that are held. There's huge collections of taonga puoro, which are carved, beautifully carved instruments that are held in museum.
And we were just talking off there too about, I remember Ruth Port doing a talk a little while ago, a few years ago, about, and I can't remember, woven items anyway. Can't remember whether they might have been sails for waka, or they might have been, did Māori have sails for? They didn't, they? Excuse my ignorance.
Yeah, so she,
trying to get it back to my memory.
She was part of the, they actually modelled a replica based on an ancient sail that toured in recently.
And she visited a museum, I think it was in the UK, and where this woven item was being preserved and got to see it. And it's, so they're saying they're preserving it and they've got the best technology to preserve it, but it's just been preserved in a vault at the bottom of the museum in the basement somewhere, I think. Like, most of the stuff's not on display.
Well, not a lot of it's not even tagged. they don't even know. They don't really know.
Oh, wow,
really? Yeah. So there's this misconceptions around that everything's got a category and it's got a number. Well, that's not so. There is a lot of information that is shared by those in who have, you know, their academic background who travel to these museums and said, they said it's unbelievable what you go down into the bowels of a museum when you get access, because there's a lot of gatekeeping around having access and seeing these taonga. The thing is that Māori actually know about them. The different tribes know a lot about these taonga, but they've never seen them.
They just know.
They just know. Because
they knew it was taken.
They knew it was taken. They know pretty much where it is. They've got an idea, or they know exactly where it went to. They know the circumstances, but they've never, because that's been passed down, that information. Mm. So they have that kind of information. So if somebody picks up the kōrero and is able to be interested enough to go and search for it, then they've got what that means for me is that there's a genuine interest in reconnecting with these taonga, because the people want them. They want them back. They want them to live. They don't, you know, museums is not an indigenous framework. They're a Western framework. They're so-called an archival way of storing.
Mm.
But that's not an indigenous framework that we value. Do we value? Well, there's some really big work going on right now around different taonga that are in the same room, what we call in the same room in museums, a lot of work in Auckland Museum that shouldn't be together. And it's hard for non-Indigenous people to understand that. I think it is, because why would you put them in the same room if you're an expert and you know enough?
Well, yeah, we're going to assume when we go that the people who've set the museum up know what they're talking about, because yeah, they're apparently the experts.
Yeah, it's a really defining word to be an expert. An expert of what? You know, when you really
expert of putting things on shelves.
Yeah, because you know, I mean, I know a lot of people personally who work in museums, Māori, and the difficulties they have with relating to the way that they're regarded. You know, then they're not really meant to be on display. That's not what they're for. Mm. They, you know, but there seems to be this interest in, well, we can find out, use them as pieces to learn about people's culture, but there's no connection to the people. It's just the so-called artifact or taonga, and they're very different ways of regarding them.
It's not a very effective way to learn about a culture. It's a little thing that's been left behind or taken from it. I mean, it's like if you took something out of my house and took it to another country and said, this is from the culture of New Zealand, Aotearoa.
You don't connect the stories.
No, what would you actually learn from it?
Yeah.
It was a glove or, you know, or a clock on the wall. Like,
yeah, there's no connection really to the people who it's connected to, and whether it was used ceremonially. Many items, many taonga were very much part of the life of the people and used ceremonially.
Mm.
And I think, to be fair, that spirituality within Indigenous cultures has been an extraordinary part of who we are. So when you extract something and you place it in a museum, and I've seen them, many taonga, you know, taonga that you wear, I'm thinking, why are they there? Like, why aren't people wearing them? That's how we would see it. It's like they were made to be worn. They were made to be part of somebody's to be celebrated, but they're lonely. That's the word that comes through really strongly, is okay. Many of the Tonga are lonely.
The reduced curiosities.
Yes.
If people can see them to be curious, even most of them, as it turns out, are in the basement.
That's a very good word for it. It is. They're called curiosities.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know enough, but, you know, I mean, look at them.
Yeah, look, that's an interesting thing. I wonder what that was.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. Can you tell us more about the karetau? I'm reading that word upside down.
Oh, karetau. So karetau were part of the whare tāpere, which is the ancient theatre system of pre-European Māori society, and it had many, many aspects. And karetau come from a particular whakapapa, te whānau o toko, and they had this, they were made to hold different ways of presenting stories. You know, like puppetry is all over the world. There's many cultures that have puppetry as part of, that are not. I think that what my understanding is, as I participated in this wānanga recently, was karetau were a significant part of Māori society within the theatre world of expressing certain emotions. They were figurines. They could be handheld. They were handheld, and the manipulating. I have some photos actually of the karetau that were available for us to see and to also experience at the wānanga.
So, do people still make karetau?
Yes.
Do they still do the theatre?
Yes.
Has that survived? Because it's something I'm completely ignorant of.
Oh, no. Has it survived? It's going through a renaissance.
Mm.
So the two people that led the wānanga were Hene Moore and James Webster. They have been gathering that information over a number of years, and now presenting it back to us, along with others from Te Papa. There were people from Te Papa Museum.
So at the moment, all my reference points are for what I know of puppetry and the mass media world. So every puppetry I've seen has almost been entirely like a Punch and Judy show. That's like a something that happened as part of a TV show or something.
Yeah,
a background part of the story. And that's because that's like a trope in the media, in the storytelling media, film and TV.
Yeah, and world. And to be fair, the Punch and Judy is quite a violent aspect of puppetry when you think about it.
Yeah.
So, and it's a very it's English. It's an English expression.
Yeah.
So it's not what our puppetry was for. Mm. There weren't any punch ups in karetau that wasn't their purpose.
Yeah.
So yeah, we didn't have that aspect expressed through karetau. They were much more ceremonial and had a place, that intermediary space of humans expressing emotions and through these beautiful puppets.
Mm.
Karetau, we call them. Well, karetau is the word for them, and they were handmade. Parts of the body could be the hands, and the feet could be manipulated.
So Punch and Judy, even though, I mean, yes, it's violence, but it also is a story that has a narrative and is a dramatic story, I guess. I've never actually watched one all the way through, but is a narrative part of this?
Narrative,
like a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Oh no, not as such.
It's not that kind of.
No, not okay. That. It's not that kind of storyline, because pūrākau don't work like that. Pūrākau express stories that are already there, and yeah, pūrākau are a type of way of telling stories, and that that narrative belongs to also Western literature.
Mm.
You know, it's just what it does.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I know, I'm just saying, like, that's what I said earlier, like all my touchstones for this are all stuff I've vaguely seen.
Yeah, so it's
from my own culture, so I don't know how similar it is. When you say puppets and then you say theatre, I immediately have expectations based on what I know about those. But obviously it's going to be different. And
Whare Tāpere is a very... There's extensive research that's been done, as a PhD. Sorry, I'll just forget his name right now.
Was that James Webster who you said before?
No, James is a master carver and many other things. He's too busy to be writing right now, I'd say.
Oh, glad he's busy.
No, there's some very extensive work that's been done on understanding how it played out within pre-European society. So very different way of expressing and for a very different outcome. It wasn't like only for adult society, it was intergenerational. So you attended the Whare Tāpere as intergenerational. You know, how like theatre, like in London, say, I've been to West End, and it's for adults. You know, you go to the theatre, but you're an adult.
Mm.
And then there might be a specific session that's for children. That's not how my understanding of Whare Tāpere, it was everyone came. Babies, grandparents, great-grandparents attended. So there was something within that expression, that creative expression that fed everybody, nourished everybody, which is quite a different way of, whole different way of presenting theatre, really, presenting creativity.
yeah. So are they doing this at all, or are they working toward doing it?
No, it's been, there's a lot of different people who are doing quite a lot of magic in different ways. I guess it's part of being on the network. If you get on that network, then you're there. You know, you hear about it, you get connected to it. Then that's when you go, oh my gosh, I had no idea.
You'll be a little bit in the network because of your work with Taonga Pūoro.
Yeah. So, and also because they want it to become more held properly, so they want to make sure that the historical understanding is held by those. So, you know, not anyone could go to this wānanga because it just wasn't for anyone. It was a very specific way of sharing that mātauranga so that it could be valued.
Sounds like they're trying to rebuild what that was from bits of knowledge from various places. Is it like that?
Rebuilding the Renaissance and also understanding who's actually holding quite a lot of that mātauranga, because it is held by different artists, Māori artists around the country.
And I almost don't understand how it survives.
Yeah, well, it's called the resilience of Māori.
Yeah, clearly.
That's what it's called.
It's about all I could put my finger on, really.
Exactly.
Because the whole colonisation process and the upheaval and all the terrible things that happened, some of them are specifically designed to destroy culture and rewrite a new culture over the top. So...
Yeah, the renaissance of this has been done in a very beautiful way, and also quite specifically, I feel that to make sure that it's held with integrity... But, you know, it's once again, it's another aspect of the resilience of this culture it continues to hold and hold on to threads that are regarded as extraordinarily important for the health and well-being of people.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm very fortunate to be part of those stories. To have those threads that are, and to support them continually. The revival of Taonga Pūoro is an extraordinary place to land. and given our times with all the different instruments that are available around the world, we're not marketing tongapuro as a... We're not marketing it, you know. Mm. It's not going to be... I don't know, maybe. Maybe there'll be a shop where you buy all these tongapuro. Maybe. And there is, but, you know, hopefully it's done with a lot more respectfully understanding who they are, who the instruments are. It's just a different way of regarding. And I know that, you know, I mean, I play a Western instrument, a flute. I've had one for many years. And I have a certain regard. One of the things I do is no one actually plays my instrument. No one else. So I don't share it. And I've noticed that, you know, that's been a practice, so that's been passed down in our whānau. If it's yours, then it's only for you to play. Like, I don't... It's not like a guitar. Perhaps a guitar can be a whānau guitar and everyone plays it, but certainly not with my flute. It's only been played by me.
Yeah, and that's the Western flute you're talking about?
Yeah, Western classical. Mm.
Okay. Well, it's a bit more... I mean, you're putting it to your mouth. It's a little different than a guitar.
I don't know. People still share their instruments, I've noticed.
Okay.
Yeah, I find it interesting. I thought, no way. There's no way. You know, sitar. Because we were brought up with respecting sitars in our family because of who they are. And, yeah, you don't just pick them up and have a tutu. You don't have a tutu with them. Mm. You know, it's not how it works.
Mm.
It's a... But, yeah, that's just another aspect to the mana of the taonga that you have under your care.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you also wanted to talk about, what's this, trees, native and endemic?
I just wanted to say...
Change of subject.
Yeah, it is a complete change, but however, I guess I'm aware that there's... the planting of trees is really important because it increases the lung value of the earth. And what we're having an extraordinary turnaround in this country, and I hope it continues to just be that way in terms of planting of endemic and native trees, because there's so much land that is just grass, like, there's a huge percentage of our land, whenua, that is just grass.
Yeah.
And it doesn't serve the oxygen of the earth. It doesn't serve us as humans. We need that. And I can hear people saying, yeah, that's what we teach the kids at school. We teach them, you know, about the value of trees. You just have to look out your window and drive from here to Hamilton. And honestly, the amount of land that has no trees on it is extraordinary to me.
Well, we teach the kids that, but we also don't teach them how to change how it is. In fact, we specifically teach them to not change things. Right, that's the important teaching around this area. Right?
You mean not change the status quo?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the revival around the use of land, the way we use land, whenua, has got to go through a radical change for our well-being in terms of our hauora.
Mm.
We're actually suffering from the fact that we are a dairy-based country. We're suffering. It's a fact. I don't need to go into the statistics about it. Dairy, there's a lot more... huge number of young people who are dairy-free, gluten-free, but the dairy-free aspect is you know, coming through stronger and stronger in our community here in Whangaroa. But it's actually proven through, you know, some of the best nutritionists in the world who are saying we've never been a dairy people, our bodies. It's very unsuitable, you know. Cow's milk is for calves. But the way that it was promoted earlier on in the century invited us to go to buy into it, really, in a big way. So, yeah, it's not going to change. I hope it changes a lot in my time, but definitely it's got to happen, because that change from less dairy is really important for our collective well-being, because most of our unwellness comes from dairy. A lot of it comes from our dairy products.
Even while those farms are there, if you look around, there are a lot of them, there are more trees on those farms now than the ones who are doing riparian management. And planting of gullies that weren't really that good, weren't that productive from a financial perspective. So trees are definitely coming back.
Yeah.
A bit.
The loss of the lives, the insect world, who are the children of Papa Tuanuku and Ranginui, has been extraordinary when we went into the farming industry. Such an extraordinary loss.
I was listening to a side thing, but I was listening to a podcast recently by a guy talking about microorganisms and how the health industry barely looks at them. But I don't remember much of it, but I remember talking about, like, you know, there's problems with bees suffering probably from pesticides, and Cam making sure the microbe, because we're full of microorganisms.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're like a carrier for microorganisms, and we're some scientists refer to us as a super organism because we have so many other organisms in us. But of like for the bees, like sorting out their microbiology for the bees might help them deal with the problems that bees are having these days, you know, which we've all heard about.
Do you mean the microbiology of the soil?
No, of the microbiome of the bees, because they have they're a system and they have microorganisms in them, and the research has all shown if your microbiome is not in a healthy state, then you as an organism won't be in a healthy state either.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, I just mentioned this because I was listening to it last night and I was like, this seems kind of relevant.
That's a given.
Yeah.
And so when we mess...
And then you're talking about the land's been stripped of all its natural stuff and reduced to a single species or two species, the grass and the animal. And then there's sprays to get rid of other things. Yeah. Like you end up with such a monoculture or close to a monoculture.
We're actually destroying ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And doing that because... Yeah. The main thing that has changed significantly is the waterways. That's been a given, that all the waterways have gone under extraordinary stress through our practices. Hasn't happened through the bees and the insects. It's happened because of our practice. And yet water is the most essential nutrition, way order, for us to survive, but we don't seem to be getting on to paying attention to.
we are paying attention, but there's a different. It was like the thing of teaching the kids about how things work, but not teaching them how to change things. There are people, and there was a news item recently about some people who are coming out. The university students coming out through the summer to test for the regional council test water quality, so they are testing it. And they'll put the information on the website and collect the data, and the website will show that mostly under the beaches it's okay, but several times during the summer there probably will be times where it's not safe to swim inland, especially around the Waikato area is known for that because of the intensive farming of that area. We have our waterways are in a worse state. So we know, we've got the data, but the will to change is...
That's
the issue.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it's that transformation from data collecting to transfer it to Indigenous knowledge, whereas we have solutions. We know what to do. We have different rituals, different practices that we understand or actually can be part of transforming water back to a state where it's actually... highly drinkable, because you know there was a time not that long ago when we could put a cup in the water in a waterway and drink it and not feel
Not worry.
But now it's like, is that going to be okay?
Yeah, yeah. The first rule is if there's been a lot of rain lately, don't do it.
Mm.
It's when all the runoff from the land is into the waterways for that, you know, few days after the storm.
Yeah,
it's always the worst time. That's like a really important rule to remember for everybody.
I wonder why we're not so interested in transformation, because it's definitely in the world that I am part of.
I think lots of people are. About.
People are into transformation.
Especially around here, around Raglan.
Yeah, yeah. It's but an extraordinary kōrero around purification of water. And, you know, particularly in the world that I operate in, the indigenous knowledge around how to purify. It's not scientific Western science that has all the answers. My understanding is that you've got to use indigenous knowledge to transform that, what we've done to waterways and that as well.
So
and hopefully that can be valued.
An example of what happens is that the regional council brought in what they call it Plan Change 1 a little while ago, where they were trying to get more farms to do more riparian management. And then some of the established farming institutions, I presume, like Federated Farmers, argued against it and got the distance removed. So normally it was going to be a certain amount of metres either side of the waterway you fence and plant inside. And they got the fences moved to within a metre of the stream bank or the river bank, which is almost useless.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not going to work.
So there are a whole bunch of people who had the data and the inspiration and the know-how and proven out here, on many farms out here, that it benefits the farms even financially. And the farmers love it because the farm is nicer to be on. And, you know, like everyone's happy. But you go into those situations and there's these establishment forces, I guess, that are just trying to hold everything back.
Yeah.
So that's an example.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah. That was a big one.
And
yeah.
It still is because, you know, it's quite... That's not an indigenous framework. Why would you do that? Why would you plant like that close to, like all of those trees? Within 20 years, they'll be blocking up the waterways. They just won't be.
It's the best we can do at the moment. It's a lot better than bare grass running down into
seems
the stream
to
and,
be.
And stock walking through the. Yeah.
It seems to be, but it's actually going to create more.
I think they try to plant plants like. Flax and cabbage trees. What are cabbage trees called in Māori?
Tikoka. Tikoka, yeah. There's an extraordinary amount of planting. It's quite clear. You can see it.
Yeah.
You know, where they put them in. Yeah, I didn't know that it was because they were pressured to put them so close. Because that's not actually where they survive. They actually survive in, and you just have to talk to the local zoo. They've got a pretty good idea of what's the best way to plant because they've got the life of animals to think about. And
yeah.
So you need much more land space in swamps. You need to plant those type of trees. And I say, you know, I celebrate the fact that we're planting native plants, but the way we're planting them is crazy.
One of the things that Whangaroa Harbour Care, which doesn't exist anymore, but one of the things they said was they would just plant four basic plants that were cheap and easy to do, but then that attracts the native birds and then they poop out the rest of the species that form part of an ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, because they were told planting four plants is not good enough, but because of just the natural processes... That is bringing other species in, so I don't know if they'll form themselves into what should be around a waterway or not. But
yeah, that will work because you're not relying only on humans.
Yeah,
and
yes.
When you rely solely on humans, it doesn't work.
Mm.
You actually have to include the ecosystem, and that's the indigenous model, is that you're not the only one we're not the only ones responsible for shifting seed around the earth. So most of the seeds and things that you know that are continually creating havoc are actually transported by wind and you know and by wind and by non-human
yes,
ways
actors.
So of course
we
can plant in the ground and do our best, but it's very important to acknowledge that we're actually part of a bigger ecosystem that we have no control over.
I think what Whangaroa Harbour Care found was you do a little bit and the ecosystem's like, right, we'll take it from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same in the harbour. They got told that it was all very well cleaning the waterways into the harbour, but it's still going to take a very long time to completely clean the water in the harbour. But once they'd done a bit of work, the shellfish started coming back.
Absolutely.
And then the shellfish started cleaning the water as well. And it's just that's kind of how the ecosystem seems to work.
It, yeah.
Just give it a little helping hand and it's like, thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, I totally support that.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to go.
Yeah.
Is not to be such the superior being of the world. We seem to think that we're the only ones that have the changes. We are not.
To be a helping hand, not a manager. Yeah, to manage the world.
To really acknowledge that there are non-human beings that are part of our world that are actually essential for us to have well-being.
Yeah.
And that those are the ones that get destroyed. Those are the beings that we destroy all the time, which I feel is we've got to be much more mindful. And like you say, teach the transformative practices around how that can happen and how we can be part of that rather than coming up with the only solutions.